the nation of a Jewish teacher who propagated doctrines alien and detrimental to the nation, he rendered National Socialism a service and also suffered for National Socialism as a consequence of his act. The Nazis pardoned him after he served only 2 years of his sentence. By the time war broke out in 1939, the only core member of the Vienna Circle still living in continental Europe was Otto Neurath. After the fascists took over Austria, he fled to the Netherlands, hoping to continue his internationally minded work from The Hague. In 1940, he and his assistant managed to escape to England in a boat while Rotterdam burned, hours before the Nazis arrived in The Hague. After the war, there were attempts to reorganize the circle, but Neurath's sudden death in December 1945 largely put an end to those efforts. Positivism continued on as a philosophy under the new name Logical Empiricism, but the Vienna Circle's grand dream of an organized political, philosophical, and scientific movement was dead. Any remaining hope of reviving a unified movement around positivism was dashed by the post-war political environment in the United States. Anti-communist hysteria in the United States rose sharply after World War II, and the nascent Cold War had chilling effects on all arenas of intellectual discourse, including philosophy. To some, the unity of science movement, with its left-wing politics, its anti-religious philosophy, and its internationalist aspirations, sounded suspiciously like a Communist Party front. During the Red Scare that effectively exiled David Bohm, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI compiled dossiers on Carnap, Frank, and other leading positivist lights. Under enormous pressure to refrain from all political activity, the positivists were forced to focus solely on issues in logic and the philosophy of science, pushed to what their now-distant manifesto had called the icy slopes of logic. But the final blow against positivism came from within philosophy, not from the external forces of geopolitics and chance that had left it battered. New arguments against some of the central tenets of positivism came from a new generation of philosophers. These arguments laid bare the inadequacy of the verification theory of meaning and the instrumentalist account of science, and turned philosophers of science against the Copenhagen interpretation. One of the young philosophers who had visited the Vienna Circle in its heyday was a brilliant American student with the improbable name of Willard Van Orman Quine. Quine had written a Ph.D. thesis on mathematical logic at Harvard in 1932. For the year afterward, he traveled Europe on a fellowship, meeting with Schlick, Frank, Ayer, and other leading positivists. He spent 6 weeks studying with Carnap in Prague. "My first really considerable experience of being intellectually fired by a living teacher rather than a dead book," Quine said later. Returning from Europe, an ardent disciple of Carnap, and with only $7 in his pocket, Quine went back to Harvard and taught classes on positivist philosophy. He also did important work in mathematical logic. But as Quine continued to work and teach, interrupted only by World War II when he cracked coded messages from Nazi submarines, doubts about positivist dogma seeped in and accumulated. Finally, in 1951, the dam burst. Quine wrote a paper that brought positivism to its knees. Quine's paper, Two Dogmas of Empiricism, took aim at the core of the positivist program, the verification theory of meaning. Quine pointed out that there was no way to verify single statements. All attempts to verify a statement inevitably involve the assumed truth of other statements, which are themselves subject to the same problem. For example, say the remote control for your TV isn't working and you can't turn the TV on. You suspect that the batteries in the remote are dead. You can verify this by replacing the batteries and trying to turn on the TV with the remote again. You do this, and the TV turns on. Does that mean you were right? No. It's entirely possible that the batteries in the remote weren't dead at all. Maybe the remote has a short and will only work intermittently, no matter what batteries you use. Or maybe The old batteries were in backward, and you didn't notice. You just popped them out and put in new ones pointing the right way. Or maybe something more exotic is going on. Maybe the remote always worked, but when you tried it before, the TV mysteriously shifted its picture to the infrared and its sound to the ultrasonic, so you couldn't see or hear it. The TV happened to go back to normal after you changed the batteries, but not because you changed them. This last idea is clearly preposterous. How could that happen? But the point remains that in testing out the new batteries in the remote, you've assumed a wide variety of basic facts about the world, all based on previous experience, and any of which could, in principle, be wrong. This isn't merely true of suppositions about batteries in remote controls. Verification of any statement behaves this way. Looking out the window and saying, "It's raining outside," assumes that your view through the window's glass gives you an accurate picture of the outside world, and that your eyes are functioning properly, and that the dimmed light and falling droplets are in fact caused by a rain cloud, and not an alien spaceship blotting out the sun and dropping some exotic substance onto your front lawn. So you can never verify a single statement. You're always stuck verifying the entirety of your knowledge about the world, or at least a very large fraction of it. As Quine put it, our statements about the external world face the tribunal of sense experience not individually, but only as a corporate body. With the verification theory of meaning left gasping for air, Quine dismissed the idea that it's meaningless to talk about unobservable things. Unverifiable statements must have meaning, because no individual statement is verifiable. Thus, the metaphysics so dreaded by the positivists came roaring back. Rather than speaking simply of sensations, Quine contended that it was perfectly intelligible to speak of physical objects with existence independent of the speaker. Quine's paper emboldened other thinkers who harbored doubts about logical positivism. One of them was a younger colleague of Quine's at Harvard, Thomas Kuhn. Kuhn had spoken with Quine at length while he was writing Two Dogmas, and he was very impressed with Quine's arguments. Quine's paper had a considerable impact on me because I was wrestling already with the problem of meaning, Kuhn said later. Kuhn had first become interested in the history and philosophy of science while he was a graduate student studying solid-state physics. He had been roped into being a teaching assistant for a new course in the history of science, and he ended up reading Aristotle's Physics. There, Kuhn encountered a strange world, one where heavy things fell because they were supposedly trying to return to their natural place at the center of the universe, the Earth. What Aristotle could be saying baffled me at first until, and I remember this point vividly, I suddenly broke in and found a way to understand it, a way which made Aristotle's philosophy make sense, Kuhn recalled. He abruptly found himself looking at the product of a first-rate mind at work, struggling to understand the physical world around him, just like a modern scientist. The key difference, Kuhn realized, was that Aristotle was starting from an entirely different worldview. Within that worldview, Aristotle's ideas made a great deal of sense. Kuhn came to believe that the whole picture he had of the progress of science, a cartoonish picture he'd picked up from his coursework as a physicist in training, was simply wrong. Science didn't progress by simply piling one victorious theory upon another. It was far more complex and subtle than that. Once Kuhn had finished his PhD in 1949, he switched fields entirely, becoming a historian and philosopher of science. After spending several years researching the history of physics, especially the period around the Copernican Revolution, he set out to expound his new view of science, which ran counter to the positivist conception of scientific progress. Ironically, he was given the perfect opportunity to do so by the positivists themselves. Charles Morris, the American positivist who had helped Carnap come to America, approached Kuhn and asked him to contribute a monograph on the history of science to the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science, still limping along after Neurath had started it over 20 years earlier. Morris had tried to find someone to write this monograph for several years, to no avail. His working title for it was The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Despite its appearance in Neurath's encyclopedia, Kuhn's book expounded a view that was totally at odds with positivist ideas about science. Kuhn argued that both the observable and unobservable content of scientific worldviews, what he called paradigms, play vital roles in the actual practice of science. These scientific paradigms influence what experiments are done, how they're performed, and how the results are interpreted. Going back to the example of the malfunctioning remote control, replacing the batteries is a reasonable thing to do, because your knowledge of remote controls, televisions, and batteries suggests that dead batteries are the most likely reason for the remote to stop working. That same set of knowledge, your paradigm of home entertainment systems, also tells you that it's impossible for your TV to suddenly display all pictures in infrared and emit all sound in ultrasonic. Kuhn argued that paradigms guide scientific practice in a similar way. For example, chemists in the 19th century believed in atomic theory, which dictated that there was a limited number of elements, each composed of identical atoms, and those atoms combined to form compounds that had fixed ratios of each element. These ideas were central to the practice of chemistry at the time and, according to Kuhn, had the power of setting the problem of atomic weights, bounding the admissible results of chemical analyses, and informing chemists what atoms and molecules, compounds, and mixtures were. At every step of the way, forming hypotheses, designing and conducting experiments, even simply observing the results of those experiments, the paradigm of atomic theory informed the actions of the 19th century chemists. And they were wildly successful, discovering the periodic table of the elements decades before physicists discovered electrons or learned anything about atomic structure. Yet according to the best science of the time, atoms were unobservable. So, Kuhn concluded, it's not just the observable part of a theory that matters. The full content of scientific paradigms influences how science is done. The interpretation of a physical theory, like quantum physics, is important for the day-to-day practice of science itself. Logical positivism couldn't account for this. What, precisely, Kuhn advocated in place of positivism is not entirely clear, and some of his bolder claims about the inability to rationally compare competing scientific theories were dismissed as mistakes and didn't catch on with professional philosophers of science. But Kuhn's criticism of positivism and his observations on scientific practice were widely seen as accurate, and he wasn't the only one pointing these things out. Other philosophers, including J.J.C. Smart, Hilary Putnam, Karl Popper, Grover Maxwell, Norwood Russell Hansen, and Paul Feyerabend, all piled onto the positivist philosophy of science in the late 1950s and 1960s, building on each other's works and pointing out irreparable flaws in the positivist account of scientific work and progress. Hansen had made many of the same points as Kuhn several years prior to Structure, in his book Patterns of Discovery. Hansen and Kuhn knew each other, and each acknowledged the other's work in their books. Hansen dubbed the role that non-observable entities play in scientific work the theory-laden practice of science, a name that stuck. This new crop of philosophers largely agreed that the practice of science was theory-laden, and that the history and practice of actual science was an important guide in developing the philosophy of science. And while there was much they didn't agree on, a new consensus began to form among professional philosophers of science, a position in opposition to logical positivism, which they called scientific realism. Scientific realism is what it sounds like, the view that there is a real world out there, independent of our observations of it, and that science gives us an approximate description of that world. When a new scientific theory is accepted in place of an old one, this is generally because it gives us a better approximation of the true nature of the world in some important way. This is not to say that the world is entirely insensitive to our probings of it. Quantum contextuality assures us that our measurements have some impact on the world, but, by and large, the world proceeds on, whether or not we interfere with it. And the contents of that world are approximately described by the content of our best scientific theories, both the observable and unobservable parts. The realists also argued that the distinction between what is observable and what is unobservable was neither meaningful nor relevant to science. This, of course, was anathema to the positivists. Some positivists had even gone so far as to say that objects seen in microscopes were not truly real because they were not directly perceived. The scientific realist thought this was preposterous. If this analysis is strictly adhered to, we cannot observe physical things through opera glasses or even through ordinary spectacles, and one begins to wonder about the status of what we see through an ordinary window pane, wrote Grover Maxwell, one of the most vocal defenders of scientific realism. Maxwell also pointed out that the very idea of something that is unobservable in principle is subject to revision with new theories and new technology. Before the development of optics and the microscope, he pointed out, something too small to be seen would have been unobservable in principle. It is theory and thus science itself which tells us what is or is not observable, Maxwell wrote, echoing Einstein's words to Heisenberg. There are no a priori or philosophical criteria for separating the observable from the unobservable. With a better understanding of and appreciation for the history of science and the theory-laden practice of science, the realists also made quick work of positivist ideas about the functioning of science, like instrumentalism and operationalism. The realists pointed out that if operational definitions are the ultimate definitions of scientific concepts, then there's no way to improve measuring processes or to design them in the first place, since that would require going beyond the operational definition. If, for example, length is defined as the thing that existing measuring sticks measure, then there's no way to design a better measuring stick, because we have a perfect one by definition. Yet scientists develop new and improved measurement devices all the time. The ideas of length, time, mass, and so on aren't merely defined by experimental operations. They are inherent in the theories used to design and test new measurement devices. The realists' dismissal of operationalism was not fundamentally new. In fact, many positivists, including Carnap, had dismissed operationalism years earlier as too simplistic to account for the success and practice of science. But many positivists still clung to instrumentalism, the view that science is simply a tool for organizing and predicting perceptions, and that the metaphysical content of theories was unnecessary. The realists pointed out that this was untenable as well. If the unobservable metaphysical content of our best scientific theories, stuff like electrons, really bears no relation at all to the actual stuff in the world, then why do our scientific theories work at all? The theories themselves suggest explanation for the phenomena that we see based on the unobserved stuff. But if the unobserved stuff is just a convenient picture that just happens to come along with the real content of the theory, that is to say, the predictions about the observable world, and that picture really doesn't line up with the stuff in the world in any way, then we are astonishingly lucky that our theories work so well. Here's an example. Lighting a magnesium sparkler and sticking it into a mixture of powdered rust and aluminum triggers a runaway chemical reaction that quickly reaches about 2,500 degrees Celsius, nearly half as hot as the surface of the sun, giving off a blinding light and bringing the iron and aluminum close to their boiling points. This is called the thermite reaction. It is weird and dangerous. Seriously, never do this. But it gets even weirder. Not only is the thermite reaction amazingly intense, but it continues to run until the rust and aluminum are used up, no matter what you do to it. You can put it underwater. You can cover it with sand. You can even put it in the vacuum of space. It will keep burning. In fact, one of the main industrial applications of thermite is underwater welding. This is because the reaction doesn't need anything other than the rust and the aluminum, along with a little heat to get it started. Hence the sparkler. The thermite reaction works because aluminum desperately wants to react with oxygen. Rust is nothing but iron and oxygen. So the aluminum rips the oxygen off of the rust, leaving you with aluminum oxide, iron, and a tremendous amount of heat. Or at least, that's what quantum chemistry has to say on the matter. But if you want to be an instrumentalist, that explanation isn't the real answer. There is no real answer to be had. All you care about is the fact that quantum chemistry correctly predicts that you'll get a violent reaction from sticking a magnesium sparkler into a pile of rust and aluminum. The deeper explanation that quantum chemistry gives, why aluminum wants to bond with oxygen so desperately, which has to do with electron orbitals, not only isn't of interest, but isn't real. But if quantum chemistry's account of thermite isn't real, then the instrumentalist has a serious problem. The theory doesn't just predict that the thermite reaction will happen. It also predicts, in great detail, how it happens and what happens. It tells you how hot the magnesium sparkler has to be to set off the reaction. It tells you exactly how hot the reaction will become and how long it will last. It even tells you other kinds of rust you can use, different metal oxides, along with the aluminum, and exactly how those will alter the reaction. And all of these excruciatingly detailed answers given by quantum chemistry down to the fifth decimal place are explained by the behavior of electron orbitals in the constituent atoms of the powder you started with. Now, you can be an instrumentalist. You can deny that electron orbitals are real things that are involved in this reaction. But then how can you explain the fabulous match between the theoretical prediction and the experimental outcome? Why does quantum chemistry work so well to explain the thermite reaction if atoms and electron orbitals aren't real? If instrumentalism is correct, we must believe in a cosmic coincidence, said J.J.C. Smart. Is it not odd that the phenomena of the world should be such as to make a purely instrumental theory true? On the other hand, if we interpret a theory in a realist way, then we have no need for such a cosmic coincidence. A lot of surprising facts no longer seem surprising. Smart went on, clearly impatient with instrumentalism. Suppose that a detective finds a lot of footprints, bloodstains, and so on. If the criminal were a theoretical fiction for relating footprints and bloodstains hitherto found to one another, then it would seem too good to be true that it should actually issue in true predictions of further footprints and bloodstains and even of missing 5-pound notes. But if there really were a criminal, then these predictions would no longer be surprising. Hilary Putnam put it more succinctly. Realism, he claimed, is the only philosophy that doesn't make the success of science a miracle. Smart didn't just see positivism as problematic philosophically. Inspired by Feuerbend, he saw it as a practical problem as well. A positivist attitude has frequently been inimical to progress, wrote Smart in 1963. Positivism would once have supported the Ptolemaic Earth-centered theory against the Copernican one, by showing that at the time it was the better, at making predictions, of the two. It supported phenomenological thermodynamics and resisted the atomic theory of gases, and today it opposes, a priori, any attempts to construct alternatives to the prevailing Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. This, to Smart and to Putnam, Feuerbend, and other leading philosophers of the day, was a serious problem, because with the collapse of positivism, the Copenhagen interpretation was indefensible. How could our everyday world of things that exist be composed of a quantum world where nothing was real? The great and compelling reason for refusing to regard the elementary particles as theoretical fictions, wrote Smart, is that unless something like what quantum mechanics tells us is true of some underlying reality, then the fact that the macroscopic laws are what they are is too much of a coincidence to be believed. And there was another problem. The most straightforward way to make measurement fundamental to a theory was to be an operationalist. But operationalism was manifestly wrong. "Measurements are a subclass of physical interactions, no more or less than that," wrote Putnam in 1965. Measurement can never be an undefined term in a satisfactory physical theory, and measurements can never obey any ultimate laws other than the laws ultimately obeyed by all physical interactions. Fixing the problem through a split between the micro world of the quantum and the macro world of everyday classical physics, as Bohr had insisted, didn't help either. Besides pushing the problem back to exactly the same problem in classical physics, "The suggestion is completely unacceptable," Putnam said. "We can hardly refer to one theory, classical physics, in the foundations of another, quantum physics, if the first theory is supposed to be incorrect and the second is designed to supersede it. Quantum mechanics must, if correct, apply to systems of arbitrary size. In particular, it must apply to macro systems." "But if that's the case," Putnam continued, "then what of macro observables that are isolated for a long time, say, a system consisting of a rocket ship together with its contents out in interstellar space? We cannot seriously suppose that the rocket ship begins to exist only when it becomes, once again, observable from the Earth or some other outside system." For the Copenhagen interpretation, measurements were a serious problem. Smart agreed with withering criticism of the idea that measurements must be described classically. Proponents of the Copenhagen interpretation of microphysics have been wedded to classical physics. They argue that since this is the physics of macroscopic instruments whereby we interpret our observations, this must remain stable whatever the advances in microphysics. That this is not so can be shown, as by Feuerbend, by posing one simple question. Why classical physics? Why not, for example, Aristotelian physics, or even witchcraft, which was once just scientific common sense? Similarly, we must reject the view that there are laws at the instrumental or macro level which are sacrosanct, and which the micro theories explain. We must insist that the micro theories can directly explain observations, such as the outcome of the two-slit experiment. Smart and Putnam were clear-eyed about the challenges faced by any alternative to the Copenhagen interpretation. Any realistic philosophy of the theoretical entities must not be too naive. It must reckon with the very real difficulties in giving a non-instrumentalist interpretation of physics, wrote Smart. One way out of the dilemma may lie in the development of deterministic theories of microphysics on the lines foreshadowed by such writers as D. Bohm and J. P. Vigier. Putnam agreed that something is wrong with the quantum theory, but he thought von Neumann's proof ruled out Bohm's pilot wave interpretation. At the time, Bell's refutation of the proof was still languishing in an editor's desk, and he was wholly unaware of Everett's many-worlds interpretation, as were Smart and almost everyone else. Putnam concluded that no satisfactory interpretation of quantum mechanics exists today, but he was hopeful that the problem would be solved. Human curiosity will not rest until those questions of quantum interpretation are answered. The first step toward answering them has been attempted here. It is the modest but essential step of becoming clear on the nature and magnitude of the difficulties. Yet this is precisely what physicists, as a whole, were still unclear about. The philosophers had successfully overthrown positivism and had a good understanding of the mathematical intricacies of quantum physics. But the physicists were still blinkered, walled off from philosophy and the developments there. They had no idea any of this had happened. While Einstein and Bohr's generation was widely schooled in philosophy, the push toward specialization after World War II had taken its toll on the liberal arts education of the new crop of physicists. Academic departments had become balkanized as they had grown in the post-war boom, and physicists, busy with enormous grants and hard-nosed calculations, were generally dismissive of philosophy. So physics trudged along, not knowing that a major revolution had happened in an adjacent field. And philosophers were, mostly, not surprised by this. Unless the real difficulties in quantum mechanics can be dealt with, wrote Smart, the philosophical objections to the Copenhagen interpretation, which consist only in exposing the positivistic preconceptions thereof, will be found unsatisfactory by physicists. If the physicists were to pay attention to the problems at the heart of their field, there would have to be more than philosophy at stake. There would have to be the chance of overturning accepted physics, of finding something fundamentally new, something shiny and exciting, something, preferably, involving a laboratory experiment. Something like finally putting John Bell's ideas to the test. Part 3. The Great Enterprise. The aim remains to understand the world. To restrict quantum mechanics to be exclusively about piddling laboratory operations is to betray the great enterprise. A serious formulation will not exclude the big world outside the laboratory. John Bell, 1989. 9. Reality Underground. It was the summer of love in New York City, and John Clauser was cooped up in a room at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies on 112th Street, teasing secrets from the oldest light in the universe. Clauser, a physics student at Columbia, was attempting to measure the recently discovered cosmic microwave background, CMB radiation, an echo of the Big Bang itself. It was difficult and painstaking work at the cutting edge of science. The CMB, a faint static hiss of radio across the sky, had been discovered only 3 years previously by a pair of physicists working at Bell Labs. Only one other group of physicists had managed to detect it since. Clauser and his graduate advisor Patrick Thaddeus were intent on being the next to hear the beginning of the universe, and to do it more accurately than any before them. But one day, in 1967, Clauser made a different kind of discovery altogether. Looking for the latest research in the Goddard Institute library, Clauser stumbled upon a journal with the unusual name Physics, Physique, Physica. Intrigued, he flipped it open, and a paper caught his eye. On the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox by one J.S. Bell. Clauser was young, brash, voluble, and had already been doubting the Copenhagen interpretation for years. Clauser's father, Francis, had a Ph.D. in aeronautics from Caltech, as did Francis's twin brother, Milton, and had trained John to be skeptical. "Son, look at the data," Francis told him. "People will have lots of fancy theories, but always go back to the original data and see if you come to the same conclusions. Common wisdom is frequently a poor interpretation of what is actually observed." Francis specialized in the physics of fluids and was suspicious of the mathematically simple yet difficult to visualize quantum theory. There were very strong similarities between the mathematics of fluid flow and the mathematics of quantum mechanics, and my dad didn't understand quantum mechanics, the younger Clauser recalled. And he kind of pre-programmed me as the guy who might help try to solve the problem that he couldn't solve. When it came time for John to go to Caltech, he learned quantum physics at the feet of Richard Feynman himself. But he could never shake the suspicion that something was wrong with the theory. His doubts followed him to his Ph.D. program at Columbia, where he learned more about the debates that had hounded quantum physics since its inception. "I was struggling, trying to understand quantum mechanics. I had read EPR's paper and also had read Bohm's and de Broglie's work. While I had difficulty understanding the Copenhagen interpretation, the arguments by its critics seemed far more reasonable to me at the time," Clauser recalled. I also found EPR's arguments much more persuasive than Bohr's. Hidden variables thus seemed, to me then, to be a perfectly logical solution to the problem. By holding that opinion, I was certainly branded as a heretic by many, and undoubtedly as a quack by others. Given his background, the title of Bell's paper immediately captured Clauser's attention, and the elegant proof contained within the short paper came as a massive shock. I said, "This can't possibly be true," Clauser recalled later. I thought it should be easy to find a counterexample. I worked and worked and worked. I can't find a counterexample. Well, Bell's got to be wrong on the proof, but nope, can't find anything wrong with it. Bounced back and forth between those two ideas, and finally it just hit me. Jesus Christ, this is a very important result. Clauser, an experimental physicist down to his bones, immediately wondered, could Bell's idea be put to the test? Clauser knew there was a chance that Bell's theorem had already been tested inadvertently as part of some earlier experiment. And even if it hadn't, Clauser needed to search the relevant experimental literature to find out how such an experiment could best be done. He already knew that Qianxiang Wu, a professor at Columbia renowned for her work in nuclear physics, had done an experiment similar to the EPR thought experiment 15 years earlier. Clauser asked Wu whether she had any unpublished data from her experiment that could be used to test Bell's theorem. She didn't, and the experiment couldn't easily be adapted to perform such a test. Then, Clauser went a few blocks north to Yeshiva University, where a friend introduced him to a young professor working there, Yakir Aharonov, Bohm's former student. When Clauser told Aharonov that he was hoping to test Bell's theorem, he thought it was really quite interesting and would be well worth doing, Clauser recalled. But Aharonov was a theoretical physicist and was working on different problems anyhow. He couldn't help Clauser much. Finally, an old college buddy of Clauser's told him about a group of physicists doing work up at MIT that seemed like it could be adapted to test Bell's theorem. Clauser went up to Cambridge and gave a talk on Bell's work. Afterward, he was introduced to Carl Koher, a newly arrived postdoc. Carl Koher had just finished his doctorate at Berkeley under Gene Cummins, and they had done a polarization correlation experiment with photons, Clauser recalled. So they told me about Carl's experiment and said, might that work as an alternative? And I said, you betcha it would. That's exactly what I'm looking for. Reading the paper Koher and Cummins had written about their experiment, Clauser realized their experiment could have tested Bell's theorem, but they hadn't. I looked at Koher Cummins's result, and they hadn't really been aware of what Bell's theorem said. With a few tweaks, Clauser could adapt their setup and test Bell's theorem. Finally satisfied that the experiment hadn't been done, but could be done, Clauser went to his advisor at Columbia, Pat Thaddeus, and asked him for advice. Thaddeus had already caught wind of Clauser's strange extracurricular activities. He was pissed, Clauser recalled. The first thing he said was, well, this is all nonsense. Tell you what you do, write up a letter to Bell and de Broglie and these guys, and they'll set you straight. This is a waste of time. So on Valentine's Day, 1969, Clauser wrote a love letter of sorts to Bell, asking him whether he thought it was worthwhile to perform a test of his inequality, whether he knew of any existing experimental results on the subject, and proposing an extension of the Koher-Cummins experiment that would provide such a test. It was the first correspondence of any kind that Bell had received about his paper in the 4 years since it had been published. Several weeks later, Clauser found a letter waiting for him at the Institute for Space Studies on CERN letterhead from Bell himself. I think that the experiment you propose is of very high interest. I do not know of other relevant experiments that have been done, Bell wrote. In view of the general success of quantum mechanics, it is very hard for me to doubt the outcome of such experiments. However, I would prefer these experiments, in which the crucial concepts are very directly tested, to have been done and the results on record. Bell, intimately familiar with the working of quantum physics, knew that it was unlikely that the theory could be proven wrong. but he also knew better than to dash the obvious hopes of the young men who had written to him out of the blue. "Moreover," his letter concluded, "there is always the slim chance of an unexpected result which would shake the world." "The Vietnam War dominated the political thoughts of my generation," Clauser wrote later. "Being a young student living in this era of revolutionary thinking, I naturally wanted to shake the world." John Clauser's mind was made up. He was going to perform the experiment and, he hoped, prove quantum physics wrong. On the other side of the Atlantic, a young German physicist named Dieter C. was having similar doubts about the Copenhagen interpretation. "It was a slow process, and not just a sudden thing," he said later. "I always had these doubts, but of course I didn't dare to draw the conclusion that these people are all nuts." Thoughtful, humble, and unfailingly polite, C. had little in common with the loud and blustery Clauser, aside from a shared skepticism of Copenhagen. Clauser's day-to-day work as an observational astrophysicist involved building and testing sensitive experimental equipment. C, by contrast, was a theoretical nuclear physicist. His work involved detailed quantum calculations. He was very much at home with the abstract mathematics behind quantum physics. And these differences between the two men were also reflected in their ultimate aims. While Clauser was uncomfortable with quantum physics and wanted to prove it wrong in the laboratory, Z understood the theory intimately and found something truly surprising lurking within it. Z had been puzzling over a problem in nuclear physics, one in which an atomic nucleus was in a Schrödinger's cat-like state of superposition, pointing in a multitude of directions at once. Meanwhile, the protons and neutrons within the nucleus were highly entangled with one another, so finding the position of just one of them would determine the positions of all the rest. "This made me think," C recalled. "I said, let's assume that the universe is a closed system, like a nucleus. It was for me a very important step." C didn't think that the universe was literally a single atomic nucleus, but he realized that the general idea, a system in superposition with its components strongly entangled, could explain how measurement works in quantum physics without resorting to any of the tricks the Copenhagen interpretation used, like wave function collapse or a split between the physics of the small and the large. Treat a measurement device as a quantum system and the act of measurement as a normal physical interaction, and quantum physics says that the measurement device will become strongly entangled with the thing it's measuring, and the overall system of measuring device and thing being measured will be in a Schrödinger's cat state. But, Z realized, it went beyond that. The measuring device interacts with the experimenter and everything else in the room, and eventually the entire universe. So when a small quantum system interacts strongly with a large object, ultimately, the entire universe ends up like Schrödinger's cat, splitting into dead cat and alive cat branches. And the inhabitants of each branch of the universe only see one outcome, the dead cat or the living cat, depending on which branch they're in. But the wave function never collapses, and the different branches of the universe are extraordinarily unlikely to interact. If you make a measurement, you get an entanglement between the system and the apparatus and the observer, C said. The observer sees only one component of the Schrödinger's cat state, and not the superposition of all the others. So that solves the measurement problem. C had unknowingly reinvented Everett's many worlds interpretation from scratch. And along the way, he had also developed a mathematically sophisticated account of the interaction between small quantum systems, like atoms, and the relatively large quantum objects around them, like rocks and trees and measurement devices. This, in turn, explained why the different branches of the universal wave function would not interact, and did so in a much more detailed way than Everett ever had. C's approach to these interactions was later dubbed decoherence. Zi excitedly wrote up his account of decoherence and the universal wave function, but he wasn't sure where to turn for feedback on his work. "Of course, I could not say such ideas to colleagues," Zi said. "They would say, 'Hey, you're completely crazy.' They would not accept even to think about that." Zi instead took his work to his mentor, J. Hans Jensen, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who had supervised Zi's PhD at Heidelberg several years earlier. But Jensen was no expert on the quantum theory of measurement, so he sent the paper to a friend of his who knew more about the subject, Leon Rosenfeld, Bohr's former right-hand man and rabid defender of the Copenhagen interpretation. Rosenfeld, who had been insulting to Bohm and dismissive of Everett, was no kinder to Zi. "I established a rule in my life never to step on anybody's toe," he wrote to Jensen. "But a preprint written by a certain toe, Zi in German, from your institute that I have received makes me digress from that rule. I have all the reasons in the world to assume that such a concentrate of wildest nonsense is not being distributed around the world with your blessing, and I think to be of service to you by directing your attention to this misfortune." Zi knew Jensen had written to Rosenfeld, but not what Rosenfeld had said in reply. "I knew there was an answer, but Jensen never showed it to me," Zi said. "But he showed Rosenfeld's letter to some other colleagues, and I noticed them chuckle about that. But for me it was very strange. I knew that there must have been some very negative comments, but I didn't even know what they were." Shortly thereafter, Jensen told Zi that further work on the subject would extinguish his academic career. After that, Zi said, our relationship deteriorated. Zi was a polite man, but a stubborn one. After Rosenfeld's disastrous letter to Jensen, Zi decided to submit his paper to several research journals anyhow. It didn't go well. One journal rejected it with a short note stating that the paper is completely senseless, it is clear that the author has not fully understood the problem and the previous contributions in this field. Another claimed that quantum theory does not apply to macroscopic objects, and some journals just politely declined to publish it, with no reason given. In desperation, Zi sent his paper off to one of the few prominent physicists who was interested in the quantum measurement problem, Eugene Wigner. Wigner was still at Princeton, where he had, 30 years earlier, first heard about nuclear fission while in the university infirmary. In the intervening decades, Wigner's star had risen considerably. He was one of the foremost experts in mathematical physics alive, and had won the Nobel Prize in 1963 for his contributions to the mathematical underpinnings of quantum physics. All the while, though, Wigner had advocated the view of quantum physics that he attributed to his friend and compatriot, von Neumann, who had died in 1957. He thought that wave function collapse was a real phenomenon, and the fact that this was not incorporated into the quantum theory he believed merely pointed to its incompleteness. In fact, Wigner had been among the first to use the term measurement problem in a paper in 1963 discussing exactly this point. The solution to the measurement problem, Wigner was convinced, lay somewhere in the special qualities of human consciousness, a view he also attributed to von Neumann. Furthermore, he didn't think there was anything controversial about this. He called this the orthodox view. By claiming that this was all perfectly orthodox, and by the respect that his own name commanded, Wigner managed to keep his work from being dismissed out of hand by the wider physics community, although he was not terribly successful at convincing others that consciousness had anything to do with wave function collapse. But Wigner was not dogmatic. He was willing to entertain different ideas about how quantum physics worked and how to interpret it, and he spent more time pointing out the real problem around quantum measurement than he did on promoting his own preferred solution. Over the course of the late 1950s and into the 1960s, Wigner published several papers detailing the nature of the quantum measurement problem and pointed out flaws in various proposed solutions that claimed to resolve the problem without altering the Copenhagen interpretation or adding to the mathematical formalism of the theory. This had not earned him any friends in Copenhagen, nor had his disparaging comments on complementarity decades earlier. Zeeman's mentor, Jensen, had shared the Nobel Prize in Physics with Wigner in 1963, and had sat next to Wigner at the awards banquet in Stockholm afterward. The subject turned to Bohr's Institute, and Jensen was surprised to hear Wigner say, "I have never been invited to Copenhagen." Rosenfeld, unsurprisingly, couldn't let Wigner's heresies lie. In a series of papers in the mid-1960s, Rosenfeld and Wigner exchanged barbs, with Rosenfeld claiming that there was no such thing as the measurement problem, and that recent work by a trio of Italian physicists had explained in detail what Rosenfeld claimed Bohr had originally been driving at, that measurement occurred when any quantum system came into contact with a large classical object. The proof Rosenfeld and the Italians gave relied heavily on non-quantum statistical physics. Wigner and others, including Bell's old sparring partner Jauch, pointed out that this was simply incorrect. The math didn't work. For Wigner, dismissing Rosenfeld's claims was not just a matter of pointing out bad physics, nor about maintaining his own reputation. He was also concerned about the reputations of his own students, some of whom had published work on the measurement problem that Rosenfeld and the Italians were directly attacking. "It is not in good taste to say about a set of articles that they do not make substantial contributions to a subject," he said in a letter to Jauch, complaining about the Italians. "Needless to say, I am less concerned about myself than about other people who are much younger than I am and whose future careers such statements may hurt." Despite this back and forth in the physics journals of the time, the perception among the wider physics world was not that there was anything wrong with the Copenhagen interpretation. Thanks to Wigner's positioning of his view as the orthodox view, the perception was that there was a dispute within the orthodoxy, that there were different versions of the Copenhagen interpretation, the Copenhagen and Princeton camps, that disagreed on certain details in the quantum theory of measurement, nothing more. To be sure, a lot of unorthodox work on the foundations of quantum physics had come out of Princeton in the 1950s, Bohm and Everett chief among them. But Wigner wasn't generally associated with any of it. Indeed, Wigner's conservative Republican Party politics were diametrically opposed to Bohm's. Wigner had received a letter from President Nixon himself, thanking him for his support of the Vietnam War, and the two men had little contact at Princeton. Wigner had discussed quantum physics with Everett, but their proposed solutions weren't terribly similar, and few people had heard of Everett's ideas anyhow. To the rest of the world, Wigner looked like an orthodox quantum physicist, even as he supported the work of students and colleagues who questioned Copenhagen. "The only man who responded positively about my paper was Eugene Wigner. I sent him a copy," C said. "I knew already that he was against the Copenhagen interpretation. Then he encouraged me to get this published." Wigner suggested C submit the paper to a new journal, Foundations of Physics, where Wigner was on the editorial board. C translated his paper into English and added in a reference to Everett's work, which he had discovered in the meantime while researching general relativity. C's paper appeared in the first issue of Foundations of Physics in 1970. He hoped his ideas would now get a better hearing than Rosenfeld and Jensen had given them. He didn't have to wait long. One of the much younger people Wigner was concerned about protecting was Abner Shimoni. Shimoni had earned his Ph.D. in physics working with Wigner at Princeton, but he had already earned a Ph.D. in philosophy before that. Shimoni had studied with Rudolf Carnap himself in Chicago, then written a doctoral thesis on the philosophy of probability at Yale. During the course of that work, he read Max Born's book, Natural Philosophy of Cause and Chance, which rekindled his long-standing interest in physics. "I was in the process of typing up my philosophy thesis. I typed the technical part, and my wife, Anna Marie, typed the prose part. And I told her after I read Bourne's book, when I finish this thesis and get my doctorate, I'm going back to school to get a doctorate in physics, Shimoni recalled. Any normal wife would have said, it's about time for you to get a job. She didn't say that. She said, if that's what you want to do, that's what you should do. I thought it was wonderful. I told her, this was your finest hour, in Churchill's phrase. It was an incredible act of indulgence and understanding. Once he arrived at Princeton's physics department in 1955, Shimoni quickly discovered that his perspective on quantum physics was slightly different from that of most of the physicists there. I wanted to do a thesis with Whiteman, Shimoni said. His first assignment to me was an exercise. Read the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper and find the flaw in the argument. So that was my first reading of the EPR paper, and I didn't think anything was wrong with the argument. It seemed to be a very good argument. I never saw anything wrong with it. Shimoni quickly found himself overwhelmed by the density of the mathematics that Whiteman was working with, and decided to switch to a different area of physics. I turned to Wigner for a problem in statistical mechanics, Shimoni recalled. One of the great side effects of studying with Wigner was that I learned about his ideas on the foundation of quantum mechanics, especially on the measurement problem. He took a stand contrary to the orthodoxy of the time that the measurement problem had not been solved by the Copenhagen interpretation. Despite the fact that Shimoni's thesis wasn't related to the interpretation of quantum physics, Shimoni became Wigner's informal philosophy consultant for Wigner's papers on the measurement problem. The two men shared similar beliefs on the subject to a point. I already was inclined to doubt the Copenhagen solution, Shimoni wrote, because it was cognate to some of the positivist epistemological arguments of Mach, Russell, Carnap, Ayer, etc., which I had earlier studied and rejected. I had long adhered to a version of realism. But Shimoni split with Wigner on the solution to the measurement problem. Shortly after completing his physics PhD in 1962, Shimoni wrote a paper on the measurement problem, affirming that the problem was real and rejecting the idea that consciousness could provide a solution. There is no empirical evidence that the mind is endowed with the power of reducing superpositions, Shimoni wrote. And furthermore, there is no obvious way of explaining the agreement among different observers who independently observe physical systems. Shimoni had never been one to shy away from disagreeing with his teachers, or from voicing unpopular opinions. When he was in high school in Memphis in the 1940s, he caused trouble with his spirited defense of evolutionary theory in the classroom. But Wigner, true to form, didn't mind Shimoni's dissent. Indeed, he had encouraged Shimoni to write the paper. Shimoni, in turn, needed the encouragement in the face of the vast indifference of most physicists to such work at the time. It certainly was important for morale to have Wigner's endorsement of the importance of research in foundations of quantum mechanics. Shimoni took a position in MIT's philosophy department while still working on his physics PhD with Wigner, and started teaching classes there on the foundations of quantum physics, aimed at upper-level undergraduate students. He also made friends in the physics and philosophy departments at several of the other universities in the Boston area, so he was not terribly surprised when, sometime in the 1964 to 1965 academic year, he received an envelope containing a preprint from Brandeis University written by a physicist visiting there from CERN named John Bell. I thought, here's another kooky paper that's come out of the blue. I'd never heard of Bell, Shimoni recalled. And it was badly typed, and it was on the old multigraph paper with the blue ink that smeared. There were some arithmetical errors. I said, what's going on here? But I reread it. And the more I read it, the more brilliant it seemed. And I realized, this is no kooky paper. This is something very great. Shimoni started thinking about how to test Bell's theorem in the laboratory almost immediately by his own recollection. As soon as I'd understood what he had done, I thought, now that's really interesting. Have the predictions of quantum mechanics been examined carefully in such situations? Then, I thought I knew one other relevant piece of literature. Shimoni asked his friend Aharonov whether Wu's old experiment could be modified to test Bell's theorem. Aharonov told him, incorrectly, that the experiment already provided such